Hi, everyone. We're at the home stretch. We'll finish off the day with a discussion on cybersecurity. Just to introduce myself, my name is Arthur Kenigstein. I'm a manager in the New York office, responsible for overseeing the examinations of our members' CPOs, CTAs, and IBs.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Julio Reed. I am the cybersecurity compliance manager within NFA.
Just quickly, we're going to touch upon interpretive notices 9070 and 9079. And just a reminder, 9070 provides members across all registration categories with guidance on the minimum requirements for a information system security plan that each member needs to have in place. And 9079 is the interim notice that came out in September 21, which provides guidance on the general requirements with respect to the use of third-party service providers that are helping you meet a regulatory obligation. We'll touch upon some cyber threats and breaches and go over some recent examples. And then finally, we'll go over the requirements with respect to responding to an incident. And also when NFA would need to be notified. Pass it on to Julio.
So I know this is the last session, and we're going to try to keep this as high level and brief as possible. I've already had two attendees approach me asking me, how long is your session? And I'm like, I get the hint. So we'll keep this as high level and as brief as possible so you guys can get out of here. So definition of cybersecurity, pretty much the narrative in itself speaks for itself. It's the protection and prevention of damage to investigation and firm information. Now, what is significantly the difference between protection and prevention? Protection basically is the protection of the data itself. It could include encryption or multi-factor authentication. Prevention is what we're seeing more so in the cybersecurity industry that's being given more emphasis. Some of these examples could include cybersecurity training, policies, procedures, and documents that's managed in-house, data monitoring, technology and operation monitoring, as well as updates to softwares and patch management. From a cybersecurity industry perspective, we're seeing these areas are given a little bit more emphasis in preventing certain hackers and attacks. We're going to give some further detail examples of this as we go further in some of the slides. So the definition of cybersecurity, as I had stated, basically is listed as above. In compromise, we're referring to certain actual breaches of the environment. And I've heard that some instances where the false positive is interpreted as a breach, which actually it isn't. It's an actual breach of the environment where some data is actually being compromised. It's basically you want to set up a process where you can avoid what in cyber industry we call keys to the kingdom, where if an attacker gains access, he has access to everything. You want to make sure you conduct a risk assessment, which is what is referenced repeatedly from some of our previous panel representatives. You want to conduct a risk assessment to confirm what are the key areas that requires cybersecurity, as well as additional and above existing cybersecurity controls. We're going to give some example of those within the interpretive 9070 and 9079. So the ISSP program, and I'm definitely not going to go into detail of this. I'm sure everyone is aware of the interpretive 9070. If you are not, I would meet you in the lobby outside, we'll have a discussion. So it's basically a high-level view of the firm's strategy overall. You want to make sure you want to implement a soup-to-nuts cybersecurity posture in regards to securing information. The document that we look for, and again, it's been emphasized by some of our previous panel members that it should be in writing, that it should give a baseline description, or if not a complete description, of your overall cyber controls and safeguards you applied, as well as risk assessments accordingly. It needs to be acknowledged by the board, as well as reviewed annually. and it should identify threats and vulnerabilities. So it's something that you have to put together, and we want you to review it annually. It's oftentimes not created, put in the file cabinet, and forgotten. It needs to have certain triggers, certain thresholds, where it might require further updates. So, minimal use of third-party service providers. Again, I'm not going to go into too much detail on this slide. I think Patty had gave a really good overview of this earlier today. The only other comment I would add to this particular slide is that we're seeing a number of firms who are contracting with third-party vendors, and these third-party vendors are further contracting with fourth and fifth-party vendors. And some of these fourth and fifth-party vendors are contracting with said AI areas in regards to helping them do whatever contractual services for the firm. We want to make sure that we cannot stress enough that it is the firm's responsibility to ensure that safeguard and security controls are extended out, not just to the third parties, but to those fourth and fifth parties if they are being utilized. It's an area that we're seeing that's growing more by momentum, and we're constantly stressing to the firms that you are responsible to ensure that those third parties or fifth and fourth party entities are following cybersecurity control rules.
Julio, I have a question for you. Is there a template out there that members could use to be in compliance with 97 and 79, or do they need to tailor those themselves?
Well, there is. You need to tailor it yourself initially, because no one has better knowledge of the overall firm than you do. So you should put something together yourself in regards to what you need to put together as far as third-party service provider review. But there is a template out there that we utilize, that we share out there as well, if you need further guidance. It is within our website, NFA website. The areas, as I said, we're not going to go into detail. It was touched bases on earlier, and making sure that you lean on the third parties to make sure that they actually adhere to security controls. So, again, these are some of the key areas that we want to stress in greater detail. Risk assessments, due diligence, and having a written agreement in place. Again, as with the ISSP document itself, it should be revisited whenever needed, or it should be visited annually as a baseline, but it should be visited whenever needed if there are any significant material changes that occur with your relationship with the third-party vendors. The two key themes that are consistent with the ISSP as well as the TPSP is that it needs to be a written document, there needs to be a risk assessment performed, and it should be updated periodically or as needed for any significant material changes. So the CFTC have proposed a rulemaking operation resilient framework for SCM and SDs, and I'm sure everyone has heard of this. And again, I'm not going to go into too much detail on it. In summary, NFA has filed a comment letter on April 1st, and our comment letter references that we have interpretive that address those particular areas as listed: information security, third-party relationship, and business continuity. So we did submit a comment letter, and we're waiting for any feedback in regards to that.
Okay, so from an exam standpoint, some of the common findings we see, and this applies to all registration categories and similar to what the last panel said, is the number one, we don't see a plan in place, or the plan in place is not inclusive of all the minimum requirement components as outlined in Interpretive Notice 9070. Everybody at this point, this rule has been out since 2016, so everybody at this point should have a plan in place. And again, our website and the interpretive notice on our website outlines everything that needs to be included in there. So everybody should have a plan that's, one, tailored to their operations, and two, in compliance with the interpretive notice. We find plans are not reviewed by a senior level personnel. This includes the initial, the creation of it, and then on an annual basis. As far as security and risk analysis, what we see in this area is, and we commonly find members not maintaining a list of critical hardware and software, including the applicable versions. also not identifying any internal or external threats for at-risk data that may be collected, for example, customer PII, and also the protective measures in place against these identified threats. Now, the INSERP does provide a good framework on some of the protective measures that you can put in place, but again, it's not a one-size-fits-all, as we've said in multiple panels. You have to really figure out what fits your operations and what you can do to protect your data, your customer information, from a cybersecurity standpoint. The big one we see is not enforcing the training requirements. So all personnel that have access to your networks, emails, files, servers, are required to complete training on an annual basis. And when we say annual, it's once a calendar year. So if you complete it once in 2023, you need to do it once in 2024 and once in 2025. Another component of training is new hire training. When are you training your new hires? When they're brought on. Now, currently the INSERP doesn't define when new hire training needs to be completed, but you need to determine yourselves what you're comfortable with. For example, at NFA, we are required to take training day one. Before we even are able to turn on our laptops, we have to complete cyber training. Now, not to say that's what everybody here needs to do, but you need to determine yourselves. And when we do conduct an exam, this is a part of every exam that we select a sample of employees and those that are recently hired and those that are required to complete it annually, and we'll make sure they're in compliance with the INSERP notice. Limited third-party assessment performed. This specifically is relating to what Julio touched upon, the cyber due diligence that's done of third-party service providers that have access to your networks or any really third-party service providers that you are using to help you meet a regulatory obligation. And then finally, an incident response plan. You are required to have a formal incident response plan including reflecting any lessons learned as a result of any potential cyber incidents that may occur, which we'll touch upon a little later on in the presentation. But before we move on, any questions in this area as far as any findings from an exam standpoint? Okay. Yes.
Most of the swap dealers or registrants in general are part of a bigger organization, and these topics, especially these topics, are being addressed at a corporate level. How do you request to provide the requirements to, for example, to meet during the exam of a swap dealer that is just a business of that big corporation?
Okay. So that's the common scenario that we've seen often, where we have a member who is part of a parent company, so to speak, in which they actually are either leveraging the parent company's resources, including systems, policies, and security controls. We will look to see first if it is actually information and policies and controls that actually are being utilized at that member's level. And if it is, then we then look at the parent company's information security policy and controls, including their incident response plan, to make sure it meets the requirements we're looking for. Now, granted, there are times where there are certain specific stipulations that would require to the member, such as disaster recovery planning, business continuity, you know, certain things like that should be specific to the local area and their activities therein. But overall, we look for other activities, if you're leveraging a parent, to be included within the members' policies as well. It should be transparent.
A quick question on limited third-party assessments performed. I mean, if you're Morgan Stanley trying to onboard, you know, a smaller firm and, you know, going three or four derivatives down, I can see how you can enforce and make sure that, you know, you're responsible and stuff like this. But for a small firm looking to maybe use, I don't know, Gmail with Dropbox, you know, how much more can you do from an assessment of third-party software like this that is mainstream?
That actually depends on your extent use of that particular software. Most likely, if you are going to, well, let me put it in a more simplistic way. if any third party that you're going to utilize has to do with any activity related to information of your firm, whether it is storage, transposing, processing, you need to consider that third party something of a vital necessity. Now, there were certain discussions earlier today with some of our panels where they were referencing a number of third parties that perform specific administrative work. And although we can't make that call on the definition of which one of those third parties that you utilize in that matter, because some third parties are used in greater degree than in other firms. Some firms will only use a small portion of that third party. Other firms will use a greater use of their services and activities. It is something that you have to make a call on and you have to make a definition on, and it's from a risk assessment that you perform that you gain that conclusion of how you need to manage that third party.
Okay, I think we can move on.
Are these requirements, I guess, specific to third parties that are onboarded to the swap dealer? And the reason I ask is you may have other sort of third-party service providers that are onboarded at other parts of the corporate group, let's say, that's not the swap dealer, but the swap dealer is just leveraging maybe some of those services.
Mm-hmm.
Would these also affect that type of situation?
So that's also a scenario we've actually seen as well. It depends on, again, the use of that third party related to the business. So, for example, so if we have like a third party that's used, say, for example, in the retail area, and that third party is also used in the swap dealer area, the swap dealer area might just use a specific service of that third party. However, the retail might use an extensive amount of services and products of that third party, and ultimately the retail has the master contract with them. So you're just leveraging, in likelihood, and I'm not saying this will be the case, the existing master contract, but you're utilizing a service specific to that third party. That being the case, and it's on you to make sure that that retail area is doing what they need to be doing to fulfill the requirements at that level, and it will overshadow into the areas that you're doing for that small piece that you're using for that third party, if you understand what I'm referencing. What you do? Okay. In my head, it makes sense, but I want to make sure you understand what I'm referencing.
Okay, go move on. So safeguarding information. So this is a component. This should be a component of your ISSP where you list out methods of safeguarding information against any potential threats that were identified. In the interest of time, we won't go into these one by one, but these are the common ones we see. Also, the INTERP lays out a framework, a high level of ones that can be used and implemented. Again, you need to determine what fits for you, what's your risk appetite, what resources you have, and how you can best protect information.
So I'll go into some of the common threats that we're seeing out there in the industry, and some of them even has had some effect on some of our members. Phishing, basically we all know what that reference is in regards to certain links that are not legitimate links when it's in within your certain emails. Phishing is voicemail, fraudulent voicemails that are not actually from a legitimate sender. And smishing are texts that you will probably receive. I'm sure some of you on that maybe might receive some fraudulent text saying, hey, your account has been illegally closed. You need to click on this link to validate that the account is actually not closed. Don't click on the link. Call the bank directly. spear phishing basically is the type of phishing that targets a particular group, account, the accounting area, or the financial area. And whale attacks are if it specifically targets certain users, such as the CFO or the CEO. Normally, it's a target against the CEO and the CFO. Rarely do we see any targets against the CCO or the CTO. I wonder why. But those are the common personnel that usually go after. Ransomware speaks for itself. One of the common attacks, distributed denial of services, basically a flood of attacks on your environment that brings your entire systems operation to a halt and limits availability of any information and transaction of information. User account attacks, bank drops is fairly new. Basically, attackers are now gaining access to users' profile that includes the users' access and password and maybe even their PII information, and then they will then go to banks or financial institutions and open up accounts with your profile and request certain loans via your new profile. So this is becoming something of greater use because of the proliferation of a number of user profiles out on the dark web. Third-party attacks, obviously, is cloud-based attacks, as well as the new area of attacks, which incorporates artificial intelligence. So these are some of the common threats that we're seeing gaining momentum in the cyber area. So some of these major financial institutions have experienced significant cyber attacks, and I'm sure everyone in here either is familiar with one or more of these agencies. ICBC had experienced a ransomware attack, and the reason, the moment they experienced a cyber ransomware attack was when they had just completed a merger with a number of small institutions. And this is one of the vulnerabilities that attackers look for when you're going through a merger or acquisition, because there is a lot of transaction activities going back and forth, and attackers can impersonate one of the representative, whether it is an attorney or administrator, and gain access to some information. United Health Group, the most attack that occurred with the greatest footprint was the MOVEit attack, which affected over 2,600 organizations globally. And of that 2,600, 2,200 was just in the United States itself. So that tells you that their greatest attack population, obviously, is within the United States. The Russia-Ukraine cyber attack has been going on since the Russia-Ukraine war itself. Recently, the United States president had issued a sanction on all Russian entities and officials. And this being the case, if a firm within the U.S. goes through a ransomware attack and you contact your local law enforcement agency, that being the FBI, because they actually maintain a master database of all ransomware attackers. And if this attacker is within from Russia, then you can't pay the ransom. It is illegal because it is now sanctioned. Caesars and MGM casinos, obviously, you've heard of. MGM did play the attack, and by the way, they're still recovering from that, which is their casino. So those are the major ones. Ransomware is not going anywhere. It is going to increase in the future. And the two reasons why is that, one, it's profitable. There are some firms who are paying the ransom. Although, as a regulatory agency, we do not condone you that you pay the ransom. However, if you are hit with a ransomware attack, implement your cyber incident response plan, contact the local law enforcement, particularly the FBI, because they are somewhat experts on ransomware attacks. And the second reason is there is now ransomware as a service where you can purchase the product, and you could be a novice hacker and go on the dark web, purchase the ransomware package software, the code, insert the client information, that being the client data, IP address, port services, and execute a ransomware attack on any firm anywhere. And this is, you could be a novice attacker. So this is how prevalent ransomware is growing, and it's going to continue to grow in the future. Okay, so lessons learned, best practices. These are some of the key areas that we've learned from some of our observations with observations and examinations with some of the firms. I'm not going to go through each and every detail of each one of these, but the most significant ones are multi-factor authentication, which happens after particular firm experience an attack, then they will implement a multi-factor authentication, which is protective control, and I'm not sure why you haven't conducted an assessment to identify certain areas to implement multi-factor authentication. And the other is ongoing training, which is the preventive controls that we sort of stress firms to push for in advance.
So cyber incidents. So here are the type of cyber incidents that have been reported to NFA. If you look at the list, it's pretty much the same as the examples Julio just previously discussed. So we won't go into these one by one, but just to provide you two recent examples of some incidents that were reported to NFA without sharing any specific details. But we did have a member CPO that had an email address of someone they were trying to invest with. It was spoofed, and the firm was unknowingly corresponding with the bad actor and wired out $1.25 million out of one of the funds that they operate into a fraudulent bank account. We also had a member CPO CTA that had someone deployed a ransomware program across the firm's internal environment. And there was no loss of funds there, but a lot of information was compromised, including for customers, third-party service providers that they use, employee information. And the firm did not pay the ransomware attacker. They did hire a third-party consultant to look into it and address the incident themselves. But again, as Julio mentioned here, this is not something we would condone doing, paying the ransomware. It's really trying to having the infrastructure in place to being able to manage it and saving as much compromised data as possible. And in a few slides, we'll discuss how and when notice is required to be filed with the NFA. But as far as, we can go to the next slide, responding to a cyber incident. So Julio touched upon this too, but Interp Notice 9070 requires all member firms to have an incident response plan in place to provide the framework to manage detected security events or incidents, analyze the potential impact, and then take the appropriate measures to contain it and mitigate it. Now, obviously, depending on the size of your operations and the resources available, some firms we find have incident response teams in place that are responsible for investigating any incidents and taking the appropriate course of action. Obviously, we understand if you're a smaller shop, that may be more difficult, but we do see smaller firms, for example, maybe use cyber consultants to help them with something like this. Need be, you would pull in legal counsel when necessary. Your ISSP should also document how you will communicate with all relevant stakeholders, including customers, counterparties, or other potentially impacted third parties, including law enforcement, as Julio mentioned, if fraud is suspected, and the appropriate regulators, for example, the NFA. And lastly, there are information sharing agencies, for example, FSITAC, which is a membership organization dedicated to reducing cyber risk in the global financial systems, where again, it's a membership organization, and firms that do experience cyber incidents do share information there. But there are, again, many other ones. This is just probably one of the more commonly one used.
And I will also add that there is one other particular website out there called the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency that's out there. It's a sub-cyber group that is created by the FBI that provides really good information related to any cyber incidents, as well as cybersecurity information as a whole. They also offer free cybersecurity on some of their links, free cybersecurity training on some of their links. So.
Just some other stakeholders to be contacted, banks, if any funds are involved that are missing or lost. If the firm decided or has cyber insurance policy, you may want to contact them to see, if this is a time to use your insurance policy and file a SAR if deemed necessary. Finally, the interpretive notice, and again, we touched upon this multiple times throughout this presentation, but incorporating any lessons learned as a result of the incident or breach, and what changes did you make to your cyber infrastructure as a result of the incident that just occurred. And notifying NFA. So again, this is another component that should be included within your cyber plan, notifying NFA when required. So this lays out when we need to be notified as far as a cyber incident, and that would be if there's any loss of customer or counterparty funds, any loss of your own capital, and then if required to notify customers or counterparties by state or federal law. To file a notification with us, you would do that through our EasyFile system on our website, and the notification filed is we're promptly made aware of it, and then we would determine the appropriate course of action. We may contact you to really figure out what you've done as a result, how are you approaching this, what the damage was, and the ultimate remediation. One thing I do want to put a plug out there for is our cyber FAQ on our website. If you do have any specific questions with relating to the ISSP, our cyber FAQ on our website really lays out and provides a good framework and answers and guidance as far as managing your firm's cyber infrastructure and also being in compliance with the interp notice. And I think we're done on time. Actually, a little earlier, so we'll save some time for questions.
Yep.
So, similar to the question before, in the last slide, you described the notification to the NFA. I'm assuming correctly that only if the customer, let's say the example of the swap dealer, being part of a line of business of a big organization, just if the customer is one of the customers of the swap dealer, should I read this like that? Is when only in case the entity has a loss of customer or counterparty funds or information, if the customer is the customer of the swap deal.
So the question is, if the customer has been affected?
No, the question is that one corporation might have different type of customers, and just a segment of those are customers of the swap dealer.
If those customers are a segment of the swap dealers, and if those customers have been affected by a cyber incident, and your incident policy plan should dictate that you will need to contact them, correct? Is that what you're saying?
Maybe the question is, what about if the incident impacts customers of my corporation that are nothing to do with the swap dealer activity? It's a different line of business.
So if, just to create a generic example, if the customers were related to, say, the retail area, okay. So if the customers were related to the retail area and the organization is able to fully confirm that it's only retail customers that has been affected. We've actually had some firms that actually had that scenario where there was a recent attack and the attackers had targeted specific customers in itself, such as like the retail area. Technically, you do not have to inform us. However, we have had some firm do a due diligence in contacting us. And the reason why they contact us is as an FYI, because we maintain a historical database of certain attacks that occur. And if this attack fits one of the profiles that we have within our record keeping, then we note that as such. And in certain cases, we might alert certain other regulatories as well.
Okay, thank you.
And again, it's one of those where you need to, if you're unsure whether you should file notification with the NFA, you can take the conservative approach and file notice.
Right.
And if we review it and deem that a customer of the NFA member was not impacted, we'll tell you thank you for sharing the information, but you know, this time it wasn't needed.
Right, and it's very rare that we will get an inquiry like that, because when an attacker attacks an environment, they gather, they go in, they grab information and get out. So for you to actually identify specifically how many customers were affected, what kind of information was taken, and if it relates to certain business area is somewhat difficult. Even when third-party investigators come in, they do a root cause analysis to find that, but it's a very, very gray area for them to be able to pinpoint exactly how many customers, what area, what information was gathered from those customers.
I'm interested between the differences you talked about in phishing between spear and whale. So for spear, it would make sense to us that, right, you want frequent phishing tests sent out at a larger group basis. But for whale phishing, I would almost feel like to target and prevent that, you'd have to have even additional scrutiny on the phishing tests that go to your senior management. I wanted to ask you, have you seen member firms do that? Like, do CEOs and CFOs, do they get different phishing tests that are more complex or robust?
That's actually an interesting point. I actually haven't seen that specifically where the phishing campaign, so to speak, is targeted specifically for the senior personnel. From our observations and our examinations reviews, the phishing campaign that's in place is provided to everyone in the firm. And what we're also seeing, and this is something that, you know, that I consider to be a really good insight, is that the technology group, the security group, is now tailoring the phishing campaigns to be specific. So that might inadvertently meet that specific that you're referencing to, because they will create phishing campaigns specifically for the accounting area. They will create phishing campaigns specifically for the trading area, because they will create phishing campaigns that they feel that certain group areas might be receptive to. But the overall phishing campaign is an aggregate phishing campaign as it is.
Since we've been talking about record keeping and the fact that you guys also have a record of incidents that happen with cybersecurity, can you go back to slide 84? I have a comment and then I have a question.
Which slide?
It's the one that listed all the cyber incidents.
Cyber incidents.
Three more.
This one?
No, before that there was a whole bunch of firms listed. One more before that. So for the first one, Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, it was Industrial and Commercial Bank of China Financial Services, LLC. My parent entity would be very happy to know that, because it was a very specific entity within the group,
mm-hmm.
and the larger group was not impacted.
Yes.
And that was specifically a broker-dealer that had been acquired, was on legacy systems. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Okay.
And the second thing really has to do with, in the event you do have a member firm that is subject to a cybersecurity incident, let's say like a ransomware attack, do you have a formal mechanism for dealing with other regulators in terms of how you communicate with them? Because obviously when an incident like that occurs, you don't really know the impact of it until much later, and multiple, especially with when you think about swap dealers and how vast their activities are,
mm-hmm.
you may have multiple regulatory activities, different regulators, and different customer bases across the globe being impacted. So I'm just wondering if there's a formal mechanism for communicating either domestically with other regulators, like let's say FINRA or the SEC, and also internationally with other regulators.
Sure, that's actually a good question. In our examination and our observations, one of the primary items that we look to see when we're conducting our examinations with firms in regards to their cyber incident is that they have established a call tree. And what a call tree is that there is a particular point of contact where you can pick up the phone, call that person, and let them know of a particular cyber incident. I know with NFA, we have what's called a cyber incident notification, and it is noted within our website. It's an easy file application program where you will submit a cyber incident. In regards to some of the other regulatory agencies, my
recommendation is to reach out to the point of contacts that you have with those regulatory agencies and ask them what is the process that they have in place for you to notify them of a particular cyber incident. But one of the key things we look for when we're conducting our examination is that there is a specific call tree in place, and that if a cyber incident occurs, it's just a matter of picking up the phone and let them know, and they will give you instructions to follow from that point. And we look for that because we don't want to see any knee-jerk reaction regarding any cyber incidents. Let's we have a mic on the end.
I think the previous slide answered it, but I'm just going to ask it anyways. Has the NFA ever historically had any active engagement with law enforcement in a cybersecurity breach or incident? Because I understand what the requirements are that they post to all of its members, mm-hmm. but historically, has there anything ever been a case where it's gone beyond that, or has it facilitated investigations or anything to that extent?
Well, we've actually had certain incidents in the past with some of our members where we've actually been notified of the cyber incidents. They've actually submitted the cyber incident via easy file, and we received the information. From then, we reached out to the firm, and this was on two separate occasions I've been with the company, that we contacted them and we had a discussion with them. And it turns out, for those two instances, the FBI was also involved because they were also on their call tree as far as contact to cyber incidents. Now, when the FBI gets involved, we usually take a step back because they actually get involved at a more aggressive rate. And for us to get involved with them, we usually just let them take the lead on that. And they actually produce some very extensive and elaborate reports that we can just reference in regards to the details related to the cyber.
Oh, they have guns, too.
Oh, yeah, they got guns, too.
We don't get guns and badges at the NFA.
If anything, we got comment letters. I say, hey, hey. Any other questions? No? All right. Thank you so
Thank
much
you,
for attending it.
Thank you.
Thanks for sticking around.
All righty. Well, thank you, everyone, for sticking around. That wraps up the program. Again, we'll have the recorded sessions and the slide decks available on NFA's website in just a few weeks. I encourage you to share that resource with your colleagues if they are unable to join us. And we will be sending out a survey to hear your feedback. Some of you already have my email. Feel free to send me additional feedback that way. It's really helpful to creating these kinds of events. But I appreciate you sticking with us and hope you found it enjoyable and learned something new. And if you need anything, feel free to call the Info Center or reach out to me, and I'll help you get connected with the same persons. But safe travels home, and thanks again for joining us.